Hello, and welcome to season 4 of my podcast, Stories of Success, your listening experience for personal development. It is here where I, your host, Volker Balluder, regularly interview high achievers, entrepreneurs, consultants, visionaries, coaches, and mentors about their secrets and experience. Join me to learn from the best. If you want to find out more about myself, or what Balluder Partners can do for you in the area of sales and strategy consulting, career and leadership coaching, or running workshops on mindfulness, for instance, please go to www.balluderpartners.com, where you can find out more about what I do. If you enjoy this podcast, please share and give me a 5-star rating. And now, let's welcome my guest and enjoy the show. Hello. And welcome to this week's episode. I normally do the introduction to my guests as the podcast starts, but this week I was invited almost as a podcast videocast guest of Marcel Dane, who is my podcast guest. So he was streaming the podcast recording live as his videocast. So you might have already watched this episode as a video. This is a new concept to me, so I'm struggling a little bit to explain it to you. Nevertheless, we took the audio of Marcel, if I say interviewing me, or Marcel and I having a really good discussion about leadership and body-mind connection and mind-body leadership over video conversation a few weeks ago. So I'm super excited to actually welcome Marcel, because he has been very prominent on my social media feed for a very long time. I have admired his work for a long time. He is an executive and he's a leadership coach, and he came out with, if I say, a lot of concept and theories around the body-mind connection in the business world, and hence the title of Mind-Body Leadership. So I'm recording this intro almost as reflection of the conversation, because being a leadership coach myself and working with teams to improve mental health in the workplace, improving it through mindfulness, I felt like I couldn't miss this opportunity to speak to Marcel. And we had such a fantastic conversation, which was going on for almost 2 hours. I cut it down to roughly about, 90 minutes here. And as a form of an intro, so Marcel's history is he suffered an illness when he was very young. And he moved around us as well. And he explains that in the podcast. And when he moved around and through, if I say, the input from his mother, he never really felt like he was boxed in anyway. He always asked questions and looked at things from different perspectives. So I think that's really what makes him so unique. So he's a martial arts practitioner. He's obviously a mindfulness practitioner. And he did overcome his struggles and learned how to thrive despite the challenges he had in his childhood. So 30 years on, Marcel is an award-winning executive coach with a master's degree in neuroscience and leadership. So what we discuss is actually very much science-based. And he also wrote a book about that, Headstrong Performance. And he's considered one of the world's pioneers, really, in this mind-body leadership category. If I say without further ado, let's jump into this conversation, which I so enjoyed and hope I will do some more work with Marcel moving forward, as we're very, very much aligned in terms of what we do. So he's currently based in Toronto. He also lives in Singapore, so he has this Asia connection. He's originally from the Netherlands, but he will tell you all himself. So here we go.
Hey everybody, Marcel here with another episode of Everyday Leadership. Today's going to be a really interesting episode because I have with me as my guest today, Volker Balluder. And Volker and I, we both work in the mindfulness and the mind-body leadership space. So we're going to be preaching to the choir today, and we're going to be talking about kind of our different approaches and the things that we kind of, value in terms of the work that we do. But it's really going to be a session about sharing and why this is such an important topic for businesses today, especially as we're starting to enter into that post-COVID world. The other beauty of it is that Volker is also a podcast host. So we're doing simultaneously, we're doing a live broadcast on all of the streams through my system, but then we're also recording this as a podcast. So I'm actually going to bring Volker in. One second. Here we go. We go to All right, Volker, you are now online and live with my audience. Say hi to the audience.
Hello, everyone.
And so we're gonna have a fun conversation today about kind of, you know, the work that you and I are doing. And now you're in the UK, is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, I'm just south of London, just north of Brighton, for those who knows the UK.
Okay. Wow. That's so your time difference. So I'm in the early morning in Toronto right now. So you're in that kind of early evening space over there, I guess, right?
Half one, just early afternoon. So
just oh, lunch. Beautiful. Okay.
So perfect.
Nice. Awesome. So tell me, you know, because of course the audience knows me.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about kind of your background, where you're coming from, and what actually got you into moving into this space as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I normally interview people on a podcast, but now I'm getting to you, and I love it. And we already talked, obviously, before we went live, so it's I think it's a first for me to be on a live show, so that's great. So my background is really actually in digital marketing. I have always been a great advocate of personal development, so my background is, you know, I have a master practitioner in NLP, done a lot of coaching and helping people throughout their career. And as my career, because if I say predominantly US companies buying European companies to get access to the market over the years, I took a lot of redundancies. And I noticed if I hadn't had a mindfulness practice, which I established 14 years ago, I think I would have had problems, you know, coping with the changes, if I say the constant changes over the years. So really that's, you know, if I say my mindfulness journey began just in time to become more resilient with the changes in my industry. So over the years, I now pivoted more towards consulting. So I do a lot of consulting as a sales and strategy consultant within the industry, but also work as a career and leadership coach and mindfulness trainer. So I'm running mindfulness workshops. As I'm, if I say self-employed, I'm working on lots of exciting projects moving forward around productivity. So I wrote a book on productivity a few years ago. I launched an online course around that. And I also have done this podcast now for season four, so about 3 years, 4 years. I should know that by heart. I don't know. I'm episode 64 or so, and I'm interviewing leaders, you know, and personal development coaches and gurus around the world like yourself to really understand, you know, what does success mean, like, you know, what tweaks can you do in order to be more successful, to on the one hand apply it to my own life, but also teach other people about it. And hence I'm very glad to welcome you today. See, I'm turning it around now, so whoever's listening, right, I hope you notice that, you know, being able to interview today and understand, you know, how this body-mind connection really works, because you have all the facts and figures and a lot more experience than I do.
I'm also heavily biased, you know, I'm not sure if I'm the, you know, kind of the most objective person out there, but yeah, I mean, absolutely, you know, I've been working in this space for about 10 years now, right, you know, so... Yeah. So it is hard to remain unbiased, right? When you're constantly you know, kind of bombarded with these signs and signals of, you know, and this data, right? You know, around especially with regards to my research, right? You know, and the data keeps pointing me in this certain direction, where, you know, it's to say, hey, listen, this is where we need to be going with regards to how we're running our organizations and our businesses and even ourselves, right? You know, and so. So I don't know if it's because it's the way I'm looking at the data and I'm biased, or if it's, you know, and so that's always one of the challenges that we have, right? So, but it's definitely been an interesting journey for me, right? You know, to you know, kind of start, you know, when I started my career, you know, first off, I started my career in the military.
Okay.
And, you know, and this is, so it's 10 years in the military. But after that, when I left the military, I'm just one of those people who has this tendency of looking very differently at the world. And it made me a bit of a problem child in school, right? When I was a kid, because I don't know. I don't see things the same way as other people do. If we talk about living in a box, for some reason or another, My box has a whole bunch of, you know, curves and holes, and, you know, it's a much bigger place, and it's, you know, it's a place for exploration and things like that. And I credit that to my parents, you know, for a large part. You know, I grew up in political exile, right? So my mom was a political activist when I was a child, and, you know, so there was, I just had this whole different way of looking at the world. And so when I after leaving the military, I had great difficulty kind of finding like a 9-to-5 job and just kind of doing what everybody else does. I was deeply unhappy, just trying to, you know, kind of doing the same thing every day. It just was not who I was. And so I ended up becoming a personal trainer. So I became a personal trainer at Gold's Gym in the Netherlands. And the funny thing was I was making minimum wage. I remember this so clearly. So I was making minimum wage, and in Holland we have winter, right? So, you know, it gets pretty cold. And I didn't have enough money for a car. I had to sell my car. When I left the military and stuff like that, I had to sell my car and all that, because, you know, personal trainers, you know, we made minimum wage back then. So, but I remember being on my bicycle, right, riding in the middle of winter, and seeing these people sitting in their BMWs and their Audis and all of this kind of stuff, and they're all kind of sitting behind the steering wheel and just looking miserable, right? They're stuck in traffic, right? And here I am cycling by. It's freezing cold. I had the biggest smile on my face. I had icicles coming out of my nose. That's how cold it was. And I was absolutely loving it. You know, I was just having the best time of my life, just working with people and, you know, helping them excel you know, just being in that environment, right, where people wanted to become, whether it's healthier or fitter or become, you know, different versions of themselves and things like that. And that was for me a big trigger, right, of what I wanted to do in my life. I wanted to do something with that skill set to help people become, you know, better. Now, whether it was always going to be through fitness or was going to be something else, that was something I just didn't know. I just knew back then that my compass was pointing towards a direction that I felt that I had to pursue. And it's that compass that actually took me to Asia, you know? So, cause I also, you know, growing up, I grew up doing martial arts my entire life. You know, so I also had a passion or an interest in Asia. I was always deeply drawn to Asia as a child. I had no idea why. My parents put me in. My mom was an interesting character. But my mom, I think I was 5 years old when my mom put me in karate class. Karate. Right, you know, and this is when Bruce Lee was still alive, right? You know, so I mean, you're talking about, you know, you're talking about an era where Bruce Lee was fighting. You know, duels to the death to be able to teach white people how to do martial arts, right? You know, it's a very different environment, right? And so as a five-year-old, I would walk into this karate class, and there were only adults. There were no kids' classes then. Five-year-olds didn't start doing karate back then. There was no system for that. My mom didn't care, right? You know, she had this thing of like, you know, our kids, you know, my kids are going to grow up warriors, and they're going to be strong, and they're going to be, you know, nobody's going to be able to take my, you know, my kid down, and, you know, and so we kind of grew up with that kind of that warrior mindset, you know what I mean? Yeah. And so that academically, that drew me to Asia. So as a young child, I started reading up on Asian philosophy, and I started, you know, kind of just really being interested. It started with a great interest in Japan, Japanese history.
Yeah.
Fascinated with, you know, the whole, you know, kind of the governmental system of feudal Japan, and right, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. And so I learned early on that I was a pretty good academician when it was a subject matter that I was interested in, right? You know, if there's not a lot of feudal Japan history in high school, right? You know, it's like, so even though I was a mediocre student in school, I definitely had this great interest in for exploration and learning and, you know, and researching stuff myself. And my mom was a big help in that too. You know, really interesting experience that I had and a conversation that I had with her, for example, was I happened to, when I was in Holland, I happened to kind of get accepted into kind of a higher high school type system. And but it was a Catholic school, and they had mandatory Bible studies. And my mom is one of those people who says, you're not going to only read the Bible and then believe that that's the only religion out there.
Okay.
So she says, you can go to the school, but you're also going to study, right, the Quran, and you're going to study the I Ching, right? Wow. Because I don't want you only being exposed to one form of religion. I want you to be able to make better decisions. So very young, kind of very young age, I was introduced to, you know, look at things from different angles, look at things from different approaches. And, so that's always what kind of stuck with me. So as I was working in the, you know, kind of as an adult and working in the fitness industry, I never really kind of believed in the singular path of this is what life is supposed to look like and this is where you're supposed to go. And especially, you know, kind of having that strong interest in Asia, I ended up in Singapore in 1995, and actually ended up in the fitness industry in Singapore. Okay. She was just growing; it was just starting. So I was working as a another interesting story. So I was a personal trainer, and I was very quite heavily into, of course, martial arts and also into bodybuilding, right? Because, you know, I hate all martial artists, right? Yeah, I had to look like bodybuilders, right? Back then, think of Jean-Claude Van Damme, and so it was part of the image, right? And so when I entered the fitness industry in Singapore, the only thing that made money was group fitness.
Okay.
So you talk about, you know, back then you're talking about aerobics, right? You know, so you're talking leotards and so I had to learn how to do group fitness class, step classes, aerobics classes, and all of those kind of things, which took me very far out of my comfort. But it was such an interesting experience of just kind of having to jump in there and apply yourself differently and make it and figuring out how to make a living. And I loved that. And so, eventually, of course, you know, I ended up, you know, meeting my wife and we had a daughter and we got married and settled down and said, hey, you know what? I don't know if this is the place where I want to be spending the rest of my career. Right. You know, so I wanted to start expanding myself as well. And so so going back to school and, you know, finishing my degree, you know, and then from there on starting my own practice and, you know, kind of doing all that. Ended up opening my own gym, you know, back in the big mid 2000s, which, by the way, was kind of a life dream of mine. And not, you know, a great learning lesson is dreams sometimes come true and sometimes you end up hating them. Right. You know, I opened my gym and discovered that I was really bad at it. Wasn't a very good gym operator. Wasn't a great manager. Wasn't a great leader. Didn't have, you know, the business pedigree to, you know, kind of run the business in the way that I should have. So I ended up selling off my shares in 2009. Saying, you know, this is not for me. Went back to school and did my master's in neuroscience and leadership, which took me 4 years. And that's kind of what triggered me to, you know, kind of go into executive coaching more so than personal training and things like that. But it's, you know, it's coming from that very, I guess, kind of alternative thinking background, kind of being more open to different ideas and perspectives and, you know, and all of these kind of things. It was what's always been driving me to be able to say, how can I add value to not just my life, but to society, right? In a way that you know, it's kind of like, how can I fill a hole where there's a void? Right. You know, where can I do something that's significant? And I learned that from my mom, you know, being a political activist. And she left quite the legacy in South Africa. Right. You know, so she's actually, you know, she earned the Luthuli Award which is kind of the Luthuli Award is like winning the Nobel Peace Prize for South Africa. So,
amazing.
Right. You know, it's and so that was a number of years ago. And so, kind of almost more like a knighthood, I think it would be a better word for saying it. So from the South African president, and so there were a number of people that were awarded the Luthuli Award back in the day, and so I've always had this great role model, right? You know, yeah. of somebody who was able to leave somewhat of a legacy. And I always thought that was really cool. And I always felt like that's something I want to be able to do too. I want to be able to, you know, kind of do something that not just, that just doesn't just benefit me, right? You know, but that really kind of benefits other people and stuff like that. And because I, you know, come from that very kind of broad thinking background, you know, and on top of that, being connected with, you know, health and empowerment and, you know, kind of all of that kind of stuff. I wanted to do something significant in that space because I felt like, you know, especially you're talking about like kind of late, early 2000s, actually, there wasn't a lot of work back then or being done in that space of kind of organizational performance and understanding the connection with how we treat ourselves and how that then affects how we treat our businesses. You know, back in those days, it was still seen as a badge of honor to, you know, to work all night and be stressed and go drinking and, you know, do all of those kind of things and then expect yourself to perform, right? And make money and do all of those kind of things. And so, these things to me never made sense, right? You know, coming from a very athletic background, right? You know, I knew back in the day that if I was going to go into the ring the next day, right? You know, and I would spend the night, you know, drinking and boozing and partying, you know, chances are I was going to get my butt kicked the next day, right? You know, and yes, that would have happened if that was the case. And so, so these things never really made sense for me. And so when I started working in that space in 2010, you know, I started to discover that there was this big void of this very necessary, what I felt was a very necessary conversation, right? Around what are we doing, right? With regards to protecting our people, right? And making sure that our people can be the best versions of themselves, despite the work environment that they might be in, right? You know, and so when I started, you know, kind of doing the research and all of that kind of stuff, I felt that there was research out there, but none of the research was really kind of pulling things together. None of the research was really kind of creating a compelling enough argument for companies to be able to go, look, here it is.
Yeah.
This is the reason why we need to start looking differently at how we're running our businesses. And there was really wasn't anything out there. And so I kind of took it upon myself. I said, hey, listen, if I'm gonna do something significant or whatever, I need to kind of, you know, have the courage to jump on this and do the research necessary to do that. And I did that from, you know, 2010 to 2014, 15, which was, which I did through my, you know, when I was doing my master's in neuroscience and leadership. And so I started looking into more energy capacity in the brain.
Yeah.
And had the privilege of having access to, you know, kind of hundreds of senior leaders, which was fantastic, who all volunteered to give me access to their brains and measure that energy capacity. And we do that in neuroscience. We can do that. You know, you don't need necessarily a functional MRI or anything like that.
Yeah.
You can do that pen and paper tests and basically make the brain do a series of 100-meter sprints, right? You know, and various different paths. And you can measure the speed of processing and all of that kind of stuff. And you can look at whether or not the brain slows down or can speed up or can do, you know, with various different interventions and things like that. So I looked at that from that research perspective over those 4 years. And I came to this very interesting realization when I was doing my research was that the my average research group, my average age was 44, right? But their speed of functioning, right, was performing at an age of 77.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's not a good thing. You know, sometimes people say, well, is that wisdom? I said, no. Right? This is literally running 100 meters like an 80-year-old. Wow. Right, you know, and then yeah, and so that for me was kind of this really interesting revelation. So you know what, hey, here we have, you know, organizations that spend hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars on their senior level executives, right? Investing big money in these people. And then they throw them in this environment, right? Where somehow their brains become 70, 80 years old, right? They start functioning like 80-year-olds, right? You know, and you know, with all due respect to 80-year-olds, but yeah. You know, when you're investing in a 40-year-old brain, you want a return of investment from that brain, you know, and so there's almost like, for me, it was like, are we setting our people up for failure, right? Are we kind of investing in them heavily, having this expectation of them to perform well? Not only that, but they also have an expectation of themselves to perform well. But then for some reason, we create this environment where they just become 70, 80-year-old brains, can't keep up with that, with the demands of the growth and, you know, and the changes and all of these kind of things. And then we go, oh, look, this guy's become, you know, disengaged. They become this, they become that. Oh, I guess we need to remove them and, you know, and find somebody else, right? So there's this very interesting, you know, kind of separation between, okay, so we have this expectation that these people do well, but what are we really doing to set them up for success? And when I started looking into that, I started discovering that we're not really doing that much to set them up for success, you know, I found that a really interesting point. So that's why I ended up writing my book, you know, Headstrong Performance, which is all around that. It's really around kind of like what is required, right? You know, to keep our brains functioning the way that they're supposed to be functioning. What can we do to protect the brains of our people, right? You know, and to really kind of start that conversation. And ever since publishing my book, it's been easier to have that conversation with organizations, right? So, and I think inherently, organizations do know, right, that you know, taking care of people is a very important thing because people are important. But I think organizations also have a tendency to get so caught up in business processes and data and, you know, and a lot of these kind of, you know, compliance, you know, challenges and all of these kind of things that are going on that they underestimate, right, you know, that power of human energy, right? You know, and that you know, it's almost like the movie The Matrix, right?
Yep.
You know, and you know, I don't know if you remember the movie The Matrix, but
I do.
You know, one of the reasons why all these humans are in these simulators is because this AI system that's taken over the world requires the energy that's being produced by humans, right?
Yep.
And in a way, organizations are nothing more, right, then the collective interactions of energy, right, of their people. And that's what generates the success for the organization. And the lower that energy level is, right, the lower that capacity to generate energy is, the lower the capacity for success.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and that's where I think, you know, in today's business world, especially as we're moving into kind of this post-COVID world, you know, that's where a lot of organizations are starting to realize the importance of that human energy.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and that's where you know, kind of I've just kind of evolved into and ended up doing a lot of the work that I'm doing today.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
there's so much in there already, Marcel. See, I don't know where to start. I think I start at the back. You must be familiar with Tony Schwartz's work, the Energy Project, right?
I know Tony. Yeah, of course. Yeah, it was brilliant. Yeah, brilliant. I mean, brilliant work, Tony. Yeah.
I remember reading his book. Must have been 2009. And I keep saying it, I think, in every other podcast. And because I summarized it for my staff, and I'm like, you need to take regular breaks, right? You need to manage your energy. You know, look at your nutrition, right? And it looks at all aspects. And if I say the book, at least in Europe, I don't think ever took off. And I don't think he has an operation in Europe anymore, unfortunately. But the work he has done is amazing and fundamentally so important. Unfortunately, I mean, funny enough, I have the book actually sitting on my desk because I gave it to one of my staff a couple of years ago and I never got it back because she moved country. She actually moved to the Netherlands, funny enough.
I'll go. I'm going to give a shout out to Tony 1 second. So I'm just going to say, hey, Tony. All right, let's see if he gets it. So
groundbreaking, but it never at least to my knowledge, never really took off in the way I think it should have, which is a bit of a shame. Because I remember very vividly having that conversation, and it goes against everything else you said, when I had a couple of smokers in my group, and they said, but yeah, smokers, we take regular breaks, right? And it almost makes people that smoke more efficient because they have this 5-10 minute downtime and this excuse to go outside. Because to your point, or Tony's point, the way we were taught to work, right, 9 to 5, 9 to 8, the more we work, the better the outcome. It's rubbish. There's no fundament, you know, there's no foundation to that. And I love how you actually, you know, segue that into COVID-19, because it's almost COVID now teaches us how we should be working, right? More in unison with our family, you know, if to say, if it's at home or at work, right? It's this, do we live to work to live, right? How do we look after ourselves? I mean.
Yeah, exactly. What's interesting, I was reading a Harvard Business Review article a while back, and they made a really good statement, is that our understanding of work, right, has changed. It's changed from a career to being an activity. And I love that, right? You know, it's work. Work is simply an activity. And it's one of the activities that we do in a day, right? You know, and there are these silos of activities that make up our day that we choose, and whether one of those silos is, you know, spending time at work, and another silo is taking care of our kids, and another silo might be working out and taking care of ourselves and doing things like that. But we all have a number of silos that make up our day, right? You know, and it used to be, you know, that it was just, it was either work or life, right? You know, this whole concept of work-life balance, which I've never believed in, by the way, right? Because I'm living proof that there is no such thing as work-life balance. There's you, right? And then there's your life, right? And it's you keeping yourself balanced, whatever silo that you might be in at that moment in time, right? But it's not balancing work and life. And I think the whole COVID thing is really kind of blowing that concept out of the water, right? You know, is that it is just simply another silo. And when we treat it as such, right, we remove the, how do you call it, the perceived significance, right, you know, of what work really entails. You know, it's an area where I've done a lot of coaching over the years, unfortunately, I have to say. But one area where a lot of executives struggle is with their identity, right? Yeah. And where you know, if you ask somebody, for example, tell me a little bit about yourself, right? You know, one of the first things they're going to tell you is what they do for a living, right? It's almost rather than saying, listen, I'm a strong believer. I believe in religion, and I have family values, and I believe that, you know. None of that stuff. It's like, I'm a CEO of this, or I'm a, you know, or that. We've overvalued, right? You know, the identity of what we do for a living, rather than who we are as a human being. And an interesting thing about that, and I think a lot of executives struggle with this space, right? Is I have this learning group that I do with senior leaders, and it's free, and so every month or 6 weeks or so, I start up this learning group, where I invite a number of leaders to become a part of a weekly meeting where we come together every week and we discuss trends, challenges, things like that in leaders. And there are people from Google, there are people from, you know, all these, you know, big organizations, and they come together. Some are HR people, some are senior salespeople, you know, whatever might be in that group. And we were in a conversation 2 weeks ago. And I thought there was a really interesting insight that came out of this group. And it was that when we start our careers, when we're young and we start our careers, our biggest worry is what we're going to do. Right. So our focus is, what am I doing? Right. As where when we're later on in our career, it's, who am I going to be?
Yeah.
Right. You know, and I thought that was fascinating because that's something that I've always held dear. Right. Is for myself is who I am. I've never seen myself as I am, you know, I am the executive. No, I'm Marcel, right? You know, and there are a number of things that I do, but they can change tomorrow. I don't know, right? You know, yeah. And so I don't have that same kind of emotional attachment as a human being as some other people do to their kind of professional identity. And one of the challenges with that professional identity is that when a person, for example, gets laid off, yeah, right? You know, who are they? I've coached a lot of executives who got laid off and got retrenched, and you know, and a lot of organizations have great kind of parting packages, you know, for their executives, and they give them gardening leave for 6 months, or you know, they give them a year and a half worth of salary, or you know, whatever it is. I mean, they do great things with people, but still, these people are kind of just left out on the street. And the big question is, what next? What's next?
Yeah.
Right? Who am I? And it becomes a really difficult thing for them to answer. And I think as we're kind of going through this COVID period, I think a lot of people are starting to realize that they aren't their job. They aren't their job description.
Yeah.
They are much more than that. And that work is just a silo in their life. However big they want that silo to be, that's entirely up to them. But it really is just one of the silos in their lives. And I think there's something very healthy about that, right? Is that when we treat the way we make a living, right? That we treat the way we actually make money as just simply another silo in our life. Number one is we stop taking it so seriously.
Yeah.
Right. You know, so things like stress and stuff like that become a lot less relevant, right? Because it's just one of the silos, right? You know, and this is something that's interesting is with a lot of the executives that I have actually spoken with, and yes, my sample size isn't, you know, many thousands of people. And it's contrary to what the World Health Organization is you know, concluding. But a lot of the executives that I actually work with, they found that they actually feel way better when they work at home and they're working, you know, with their families, and that they felt a lot more productive, and they felt a lot more, you know, their stress levels were way lower. They were taking time to take care of themselves, right? They were starting to work out a lot more. They weren't traveling as much, right? You know, so they were home with their families and their kids. So their relationships with their families were a lot better. And a lot of these, you know, executives are going, "Whoa, we should do this forever," right? You know, and that's the interesting thing about it, right? You know, is the way we were doing things simply wasn't working. We thought it was working, right? Because a lot of people just didn't have the courage to say, let's do it differently, right? You know, let's challenge this. Nobody really kind of wanted to go there because they said, well, why? It's working, but it wasn't working, right? You know, it was functioning, right? You know, and that's what I find, yeah. So
I think we never questioned it, and I'm 100% with you. I started using the term work-life balance again because it resonates more with people. But for many years, I used the term life-life balance, right?
Uh-huh.
Which I think was David Allen, I think, to his credit, Getting Things Done, who you know, coined that phrase in the first place. Which also got me to become more freelance, right? And to your point, my online course is about values and purpose, right? It's about discovering who you really are, because... And it's so interesting to listen to you, because it's just, if I say it's a deja vu of my life, and if I say if it's a deja vu of my life, because, you know, I'm just a normal person, it's probably a deja vu for most people, because you from a young age, you get distilled, you have to go to university, you have to get a good job, you have to have that title. You know, it's all about status. And not many people grow up with, you know, I think you're very lucky to have a mother that says, you know, look at different angles. Right, I never had that, and you know, and no discredit to my parents at all, because they weren't used to doing that, right? They were never taught to do that.
And it's just, no, society does that, right? I mean,
exactly.
it's just dictated by society, right? So we're just, you know, as animals, right? We're just, you know, unfortunately, but we're just doing what society kind of dictates, right?
We just herd animals, we just go for it, and we do what everyone else has done. And we don't question enough. And I think it sounds a little bit cheesy, but I don't know who said it, but you know, the best gift you can give your children is to ask lots of questions, right? And I think it's exactly that, right? Question why you're doing things, and for what. And if you know, it took me to your point in terms of, you know, you start your career, you know what, you know, you're aiming high and high and high. And it took me a couple of layoffs to realize, actually, what is it I want to do, right? Where do I add the most value? On the one hand, if I say for others, but then also if I say to my own life. So what could I do that reflects my value and purpose in life? And it would be so much nicer to do that the other way around, right? And that's what I'm teaching my children, right? I tell them, you know, find something you really enjoy doing and then go for it. Because money comes with your passion, right? And how important is money at the end of the day, right?
You know what is interesting is that tends to be the going theme, right, with parenting, you know, in today's world. And the same counts for me. I think we've all kind of learned that, right? We've all, you know, that would be an interesting research project right there, right? It's to look at, you know, kind of how we were raised as a generation, right? You know, and in terms of the things that we valued, right? And I think I think you nailed on the head is that as children, we were raised to value extrinsic things, right? And that those extrinsic things, our things on the outside, right? Our jobs, our money, you know, what we own, have the big house, having, you know, and that would then reflect on kind of who you are, right? And the reason probably is because we were raised from parents in poverty, right? You know, people who, you know, who went through, you know, the Second World War, you know, whose parents or either grandparents went through the Second World War and knew starvation, and they, you know, it's like accumulate as much as you can, right? Because you never know what's going to happen, right? You know, hamster up, right? You know, and so, you know, we were kind of raised in that generation of this is what you got to do to be successful. And of course, now we've all kind of climbed that ladder, coming to realization, no, that isn't the answer. The interesting thing, though, is that, you know, as our generation is in raising our kids, and we're saying, listen, do what you love, right? Do what you enjoy, find yourself, do all of these kinds of things. And then these kids enter the workspace, right? Yeah. And discover they hate it, right? Yeah. You know, and as they're then discovering that they hate the workspace because they're being told that they're not doing a good job, they're being, you know, all of that, they jump from one job to another very, very quickly, right? Because they can't find, you know, that one thing they love, right? Yeah. Because there's unfortunately a lot of jobs out there. There are elements in each job that we have to do things that we don't love, right? That we really absolutely hate doing. But in order for us to be successful in some way or another, we have to be prepared to do the things we don't want to do, right? You know, to be able to achieve them, right? You know, so I anticipate with that, with an upcoming generation, is they're you know, and you see that in the recruiting industry today. You see that with work trends of younger adults and millennials, right? That there's very little, you know, loyalty towards, you know, kind of staying in companies and things like that. So it changes a lot of the dynamics as well, right? You know, with regard to but I anticipate that there are going to be a lot of, you know, young adults out there who don't have necessarily the resilience or the staying power, right? Because they've never been taught how to have that staying power and how to have that resilience, right? You know, and so that's going to be an interesting thing to look out for, I think, in the next, you know, 10, 15, 20 years of how, you know, how society manages that. But, you know, what can come from that, you know, thinking out of the box, The good thing that can come from that is we've become very philosophical.
That's good. I like that.
But is that this generation is also going to be shaping the workplace of the future.
Exactly. I was about to say,
you know?
Because is it a question that the workplace hasn't adopted yet, right? So to what we said earlier, whilst, you know, the younger generation comes in with a new concept of work, right? Which I think, as we're seeing at the moment, right? They're working from home, you know, working remotely, you know, working from anywhere. And there have been, you know, to your point, there have been very little companies that pioneered that pre-COVID. And now a lot of companies go like, we don't need an office anymore. We can save the costs. I think it was the CEO of Basecamp, I believe it is. I think Basecamp has been working remotely all, you know, forever. And I think the employees get money every year for a family holiday, you know, instead of office costs, if you like. And it's a fantastic concept. And hopefully we're going to see more of that. And exactly what you just said, I think the younger generation will form a new workplace. But the other question I have, and I know you've done a lot of work in that, and you just mentioned resilience. Do the younger generation, will they be less resilient? Or how can we teach them to become resilient?
Yes, I mean, you know, there's a famous term called boosterism, right? You know, and so we live in a society of boosterism, right? Where we feel that it is our responsibility to boost the self-esteem of our children.
Yeah.
Right. And it's to a point, right, where a lot of parents don't only become helicopter parents, right, but they become lawnmower parents, right? You know, lawnmower parents are the parents who kind of get rid of the challenges and the obstacles for their kids before the kids reach them so that they have smoother sailing into their lives, right? And we see that in schools. We see that, you know, and everybody has to be a winner, and there aren't allowed to be any losers, and this, you know. And so when kids grow up in that kind of environment, there is a big chance that these kids are not going to have the the psychological resilience, right, to be able to work in a corporate environment, right, where they're told they're not doing a good enough job, you know, and if that's going to be the first time they hear they're not doing a good enough job, you know, what's going to be the outcome of that, right? You know, and we see that. We see a lot of kids now who kind of are entering into the workforce thinking that, you know, they have the the fortitude to already be the CEO of the company, right? You know, and because they've been told all their lives how amazing they are, right? You know, not understanding that there's still so much growth to be had. And so I think, you know, what we would ideally want, right, is some form of blend, right? I do think though that one area where we can enhance a child's resilience is actually in sport.
Yep.
Right. You know, I think sport. But looking at my own daughter, for example, you know, she's a former Division I athlete in the U.S. And if you as she's now entering into the workforce, and this is all, you know, like literally, I'm just trying to stay out of the way.
Yeah.
Right. You know. But as she's entering into the workforce, she's coming to certain realizations herself about herself. Right, you know, of certain strengths and things like that she has over, you know, maybe some other people in that she's competing with for jobs or doing all of that kind of stuff, and she's coming to the realization that her experience as an athlete has really helped her on that resilience front, you know, where you know she is open to feedback, she is open to, you know, kind of learning, and she is always looking at how can I do it better and how can I, you know. So there are definitely these kids out there that, you know, this isn't all kids, I think, but I do think that from a parenting standpoint, or as we're raising our kids, is I think elevating self-esteem is really, or protecting self-esteem is really important, protecting self-worth, all of those kind of things are really important. But at the same time, there needs to be this muscle that we need to be making sure they're flexing, right? You know, but then also being able to teach them the skills, how to manage that, right? You know, that when they're in a sport and they're losing, right? You know, how to deal with loss, right? How do you protect yourself from, you know, the depression that you might end up having if you've lost, or, you know, and how can you flip that, right? How can you change that mindset to, you know, something exciting and growth oriented and, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. So I think there are, I think, you know, there are these opportunities, right? And it's it's whether or not parents understand that, right? Whether or not parents are you know, kind of saying, hey, listen, I'm gonna put my kid in this sport, right? Yeah. To, you know, just for that reason, right? I'm gonna put my kid into rugby because, you know, the more bashing my kid gets to do, right? Yeah. You know, in a safe environment, right? It's just gonna be good for him or her, right? You know, and I think that's an important component of this. Can you as a parent kind of just voluntarily put your kid into these yeah. type of situations and give them the tools, teach them the tools and how to get themselves out of it and actually how to have the upper hand. And that's, yeah. this is not something that is going to be taught to them, in many other areas, right. And not in school, not in, you know, and this kind yeah. of stuff. This is really going to be, and the other challenge with that, right, is that if you look around the world, the amount of kids taking part in sports is shrinking.
Oh, really? I wasn't aware of that.
Right? Yeah. Okay. So yeah. So one of the challenges, right, that we have is the increase in sedentary activity in children. Right? There is still today, right? There is a continued decrease in physical activity. You know, yeah. and you look for example, you know, a famous country where they do a lot of research, right? And this is why the data is there, is like, for example, in the United States, where the number of hours of physical activity in public schools, right, has dropped to almost zero,
wow.
right? Because the schools don't have the funding, they don't have the support, they don't have the coaches, they don't have, you know, and so we're also starting to see that a lot of, you know, a lot of schools are you know focusing so because the academic rigor, right? When you look at academic competitiveness,
yeah,
right, and how kids have to compete academically, it is insane, right? You know, when my daughter graduated from high school, the whole idea is, you know, is she going to make it? You know, not for my daughter, but like her the college, yeah. is she going to get into Harvard or Yale or you know,
yeah.
is it, because there aren't many other choices for you, right? If you want a successful career,
yeah.
right? You know, and so you have to kids are being raised with this belief system that you know the type of university they're going to. So school has become a stepping stone, right? To another level, right? And where they go to university is then a stepping stone to the type of job that they're going to have, the type of career that they have, that still exists in society today.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and so one thing that we're seeing is the stress levels in children, right. You know, more. So a very interesting research from the American Psychological Association. They have actually done a lot of research on high schoolers. And they've discovered that over the past, you know, kind of, you know, decade or so, the number of the stress levels in kids has yeah. risen to areas levels above working adults, right? You know, so there's so much anxiety, so much fear, so much, you know, stress that these kids yeah. are undergoing because their society is kind of dictating to them that they have to fit in a certain box, right? And that box, you know, is only, you know, available for, you know, maybe 1% of the population.
Yeah.
And so the things that these kids have to do to make it into that box requires them to unfortunately, and most often
yeah.
is sacrifice their sport, right. You know, and sacrifice physical activity yeah. because these educational institutions, they look at, you know, they might say, hey, listen, we want a kid who's well-rounded and he plays sports and things like that. But they really want somebody who is still kind of very academically accomplished, yeah. right? You know, and on top of that is, you know, and you know, various different, you know, is in the World Peace Corps and is this and you know, and so it almost has to, you know, you have to almost be like the superhuman, right? You know, to make it into these levels. And so there's not a lot of room, right, for these kind of kids in that space of taking care of themselves.
Yeah.
Right. You know, of making sure that, you know, they are exercising and they're playing a sport and they're playing, right? You know, just, you know, what we know now from the psychological yeah. perspective of how much brain development actually happens when we just play, without any type of goal, right? You know, and you know, that kind of brings me to what I was talking about earlier, that, you know, that leadership group that I host. Yeah. I was doing a regression exercise with them a little while ago, where they, you know, we all kind of went back to our childhoods and kind of reconnected with how we learned as children, yeah, you know, before we started going to school. And, you know, and as they came out of it, you know, some, you know, one of them said, "Hey, I discovered, you know, I was a real tactile learner. Like, I was happiest when my hands were in the mud," right? You know, yeah. And so then the question is, well, how do you learn now? Right? What's changed? Right? You know, it's like, and maybe do you need to get your hands dirty now too? Right? It's, you know, and so can you connect with that a little bit? Right? And there was one person who said something really interesting, and he said what his discovery was when he was kind of observing himself as a child, is that when children learn, or when he was learning to start, he was just so immersed in the experience of learning, right? He didn't care where it was taking him.
Yeah.
Right? You know, he was just having fun. He was just enjoying, right, where you know, learning, right, without really kind of worrying about where it was going. And I think we're losing sight of, you know, that learning is play, right? You know, that's how the human being learns. That's how we learn. And we've done everything possible to deconstruct learning so that we can remove, and we do that in work too,
yeah,
right? We've deconstructed everything so that there is the minimal amount of play possible and yet the most amount of work possible, right? Yeah. But God forbid, we're going to have some fun. Right. You yeah. know, so let's play just for the sake of playing. No, there doesn't have to be an objective. There doesn't have to be a reason. And yeah. from a neuroscience perspective, we know that's when the brain functions best. Right. You know, it's actually when we're having a good time, you know. Yeah. And so that's, you know, I think that's one of the challenges yeah. with schooling systems of the future. Right. You know, is how are we going to create that? Because that's what sport is. Right. Sport is physical play.
Yeah.
And through that physical play, you know, we learn a lot of life lessons, and we learn how to apply ourselves in life. You know, it's much more than just, you know, making your heart pump and bring oxygen into your brain and to do all of those kind of things. Yeah. A tremendous amount of things that we can learn. And so as we start sacrificing, right, those kind of things for this kind of like this box that we want to fit in. You know, that's when, you know, we're going to start seeing kind of the crumbling of kind of that next generation, so many factors in so many ways, right? You know, unless we do something about it, right? Yeah. You know, and that's the challenge, right? You know, So
I don't know how much you have heard about that over in Canada, but the A-levels fiasco in the United Kingdom, right? Where, you know, they decided a very poorly designed, you know, I'm knowing a lot about data, you know, data analysis, you know, and I'm going like, how could anyone, you know, with any knowledge about data science could develop an algorithm that puts, you know, these poor kids into a situation where they get grades, you know, that are not even on the spectrum, like that bad, although they got predicted really high grades. I mean, government did a big U-turn. I mean, one of many, but let's not talk politics. Never get off the phone. But
oh yeah, absolutely.
I remember we were driving back from Scotland when the news broke, and I couldn't stop, if you say, thinking about these poor kids. Right, they're just doing their A levels. They're just starting out, and their stress levels, their anxiety. What is my grade? What does it mean? Will I go to university? Will I be able to do what I want to do? Right. And of course, the parents as well. And you're so, if I say, paralyzed because you can't do anything, right? It's so out of your hands. And being
That's
able
right.
to cope with that, obviously, you do a lot of, and the reason I'm mentioning that, you just mentioned stress level, in particular in kids. How does mind work? I mean, if I say, how does the mind work help kids? I mean, should we... And that's something I would argue. Should we start teaching mindfulness in schools alongside sports? We just talked before we went live, we briefly touched on, I just recently read George Mumford's book, The Mindful Athlete. Yeah. bringing that, you know, and you'd have done so much work. If I say he's almost probably a competitor to yours in from a business point of view.
Or, in this field, there are no competitors. There's so much work to be done. Yeah.
I mean, that work, you know, body-mind connection, whether it's an athlete, a student, a child, but then, of course, there's leadership as well. How do we get more of that? And you know, yeah, I mean, it's your topic. You can probably best take it away.
it's really interesting. I think one of the challenges, right, is our psychological makeup and what motivates us, what drives us, right? Yeah. You know, so between what we need and what we want, right? You know, those are different psychological drivers, and our the way our brains are shaped and the way that we value the information that is coming into our minds, right? Yeah. The filters that we use as human beings to decide what information is relevant and what information isn't, right, is a very important factor here, yeah. Right? So I think the challenge, right, you know, and of course this is just me, you know, speculating, but I think one of the greatest challenges that we're dealing with is mindfulness is not the answer.
Okay.
Right? And the reason is because it's too simple of an answer. The problem is much bigger, right? It's much more holistic. Let's put it that way, right? And it's mindfulness is a very important tool.
Yeah.
That I am going to say, right? So it is definitely a tool that should be in the toolbox, but it's not the answer. And even though I practice mindfulness, I teach mindfulness, I do all of these kind of things, but this is something I say in all of my leadership trainings, is mindfulness is not the answer. It is a tool, right? You can't fix a car with only a screwdriver. We need many more tools, yeah, right, in that toolbox. And but it is an important tool. And I think where we even need to go even further, right, is I was in a workshop a couple of weeks ago, and the lecturer in this workshop made a really good point. And he was saying that that generally speaking, right, as human beings, and we're looking at this very more philosophically than scientifically, but yeah, but generally as human beings, we have three ways of learning, right? There's what he called the epistemological learning. There's ontological learning, and then there's cosmological learning, right? Now the distinction between the three, right, which is really important here, is we are all raised in an epistemological society. Epistemological is the science, is knowledge,
yeah,
right? It's learning with rules, right? You know, and the rules in science, right, are generally, if we can't see it, it doesn't exist, right? It only exists once we can see it,
yeah,
right? One of Einstein's greatest challenges, right, was the fact that none of his theories could be proven right.
Yeah.
Right? The only reason why they're so famous is because to date nobody's been able to prove them wrong either.
Yeah.
Right? But generally speaking, a theory is a theory. And it's scientifically we can only say it's true if we can prove it to be true. Right? And the way that we do that is by vision, is by what we can see and what we can interpret. And we look for data. We look for data points and things like that do that. Now, and I'm a Western trained scientist, right? You know, so I come from that space as well of looking at those data points and, you know, what are my outliers and, you know, and what's my bell curve and, you know, all of those kind of things. And one of the challenges, if you look at kind of education, right, you know, and how we were raised, is that Western society has created an educational system that is predominantly, I would say, 90 to 99% epistemological, yeah, right? It's looking at math, it's looking at this, it's looking at, you know, all of these kind of Western sciences, right? And that's all fine, but what that does is it creates a filter of kind of one way of looking at the universe, of looking at the world, looking at possibilities, looking at the, we only have that box that we kind of, that lens that we then look through. But then there are also these two other areas, which is ontological. Yeah. And ontological is basically intuition, right? You know, it's kind of a gut feeling. How do things feel in my body? What's my body telling me about where I am actually going? And and if you think about a lie detector test, for example, right? So you could say lying is a mental process because, you know, when people lie, it's psychological. They're thinking about it and they're speaking the lie. But when you have a lie detector test, it looks at physiological markers, right? It looks at blood pressure, looks at your heart rate, looks at your pulse, looks at your temperature of your skin. It looks at all of these. And the reason is because the body can't lie. Right. It doesn't know how to.
Okay.
You know, and so the body is there's an infinite amount of wisdom in the body that simply doesn't lie. And so there's a lot that we can learn about each other and a lot that we can learn about ourselves if we learn to listen to what our body is actually saying. Yeah. Right. And also if we learn how to communicate through our bodies. Right. Because we communicate with body language, with energy. Yeah. Right. And energy transfer. There's a lot of interaction that happens there. But if we're not looking at it from a right lens, and we're not opening ourselves up to the learning lessons that are actually coming from it, we limit part of that kind of wisdom. Right. And then the third one is cosmological, which is really kind of, it's the infinite wisdom from the universe.
Yeah.
Right. You know, we can talk about spirituality. We can talk about religion. We can talk about just kind of, the way the universe is connected with, neutrons and protons and so
there's a
lot of, there's so much going on out there, right? But we are limited in our field of vision. We are limited in our auditory spectrum. We are limited in what we can feel and touch. Right. So we only perceive such a small part of this universe. Right. That becomes our reality. Right. That's why they say perception is reality. So when we find ourselves in that kind of position, we close ourselves off to whatever signals and signs and, things like that that are out there. An interesting conversation I was having with actually a guy who's a senior recruiter for kind of like one of the top IT firms in the world and has recruited, he recruits the CEOs and the top, like these top people. And he says this, the one thing that sets these top people apart from the not so top people is the order in which they actually use those three. So for example, generally speaking, we predominantly look at epistemological data, epistemological information. We're looking at processes. We're looking at things that are tangible that we can touch. And that data, then when we analyze that data, right, we might create a gut feeling, right? Kind of said, hey, where we need to go. And then that gut feeling, we might be able to say, let's throw that out in the universe and see what sticks and what happens, right? As where these top leaders operate differently. They just tend to be different type of animal. Yeah. Nobody taught them to do this. There's not a school in the world that teaches you to do this, right? But they actually do it the other way around. So if you think, for example, Steve Jobs, right, when he invented the iPod, right? If he was an epistemologically driven human being, right, he would have looked at all the data, all the touch points, and he would have gone, man, that iPod would never work. Right, because there was no amount of science, no amount of data, right, that would be able to show that, this iPod is actually going to work, right? So he got this vision, and he got this, somewhere from the universe told him that this is what you got to do.
Yeah.
And that gave him a gut feeling, right, of kind of saying, that's the direction that we need to go. And then he started kind of with research and doing all of these kind of things, and as he started developing a team of people, right, that kind of, started putting this thing together, right, out of that started coming some epistemological data that confirmed that, hey, listen, you're on the right path, right? So he operated in a different way. And so what this guy was saying is that that's how a lot of the top, you know, the famous CEOs that we know and entrepreneurs, right? They have a tendency to just naturally be able, they have a talent to be able to naturally do that, as where the majority of us, we're stuck in doing it the opposite way around.
Yeah.
And that's what we think we need to do, right? You know, and so there's this realm, right? Or maybe a couple of realms, right? Of possibility that we're not exploring and that we're closing ourselves off to. And the educational system is contributing to that. Right. You know, and so how we are teaching kind of in Western society, how we are teaching our kids to trust themselves and trust the data and trust the information, right, is through knowledge, right? You know, rather than just simply knowing, right? Because it feels right. Right. You know, and that's I think there's a bigger conversation to be had, right? Around you know, a great example is my daughter, who was she was very, very young. I think she was in first grade, and she was learning math.
Yeah.
And I remember this very, very clearly. And she was crying in her bedroom, crying because the teacher wanted her to follow certain steps to be able to do this math equation. So listen, step one, you have to do that. Step two, step three, that's how you get to the answer. And my daughter was like, it doesn't make sense to me. Right. But the funny thing was, is she would look at the question and she just know the answer.
Right.
But she wouldn't know how she got to the answer, but she just knew it. But knowing the answer wasn't enough. Right. There had to be these certain steps.
Process. Right.
And so, right. Yeah, exactly. And so the teacher was telling her that she wasn't doing it right.
Yeah.
Right, even though she knew the answer, and that's what upset her so much, is because what makes this so wrong? Because I know the answer, and so when I was working with my daughter, I was teaching her about just kind of learning to trust that intuition, learning to trust that side of your brain that is just giving you the right answer, but then to use kind of that more that knowledge way to create a confirmation that you were right.
Yeah.
To say, listen, you know the answer, fantastic. But now what you do is you create those steps just to confirm that you are right. And then she understood. She said, oh, okay. And then she figured it out. And all of a sudden she was like, oh, you know, she got it, right? You know, and it's just really interesting that we learn from a very, very young age that there's this right way and this wrong way.
Yeah.
Right? You know, and there's not enough room for exploring and you know, just using that gut feeling and intuition and all of that kind of stuff. It's no, that's the wrong way of doing it. You have to do it this way. Those are the big challenges that we actually encounter. And interestingly, you know, if you look at, for example, Finland, right?
Yeah.
So Finland has announced that they're actually going to remove their entire kind of epistemological education system.
Really?
They're scrapping. Yeah, they're scrapping it, and yeah, leave it up to Finland. Finland is such a progressive society when it comes down to leadership and things like that, and education, right?
Yeah.
And they're going to completely scrap it, and they're going to rewrite it based on the needs of the society of the future, right? Rather than on a society that had to function 150 years ago, right? You know, and so. So yeah, so it is happening, right? So people are starting to explore this in you know, in a different way.
So is that what you're teaching to your leaders as well when you work with them? I mean, is it teachable?
Yes.
Is the other question, right? Because I mean, you just, you know, kind of answered that question with Finland, but will everyone be able to learn it? Maybe that's a better question.
So yeah, so absolutely. I mean, the beauty is it's not even learning how to do it. It's just learning how to listen.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and are you able to? And this is where mindfulness becomes really important, because in mindfulness you can put yourself in a state, right, where you can actually listen, right? You know, and you know, stop talking, start listening, right? You know, and listening is such an important place to be. And just allow yourself to listen without a narrative, without guidance, without this is the only thing I want to listen to. No, just listen, right? You know,
yeah.
And that's where, and that takes mindfulness practice. That takes, you know, there are certain things that we can do, and also, you know, movements of the body, right? You know, moving the body in certain different ways allows us to open up those energy fields and allows us to kind of open ourselves up to kind of the information that's coming out there. But it also allows us to open ourselves up to each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, because like I said, you know, we're all projecting energy, but we project different types of energy, right? You know, we project positive energy, negative energy. We project light energy, heavy energy, you know, so there are different types of energy that we project based on our moods and our thoughts and our psychology and all of these kind of things. And as a leader, you know, we want to make sure that our organization can project a certain energy,
yeah.
You know, and that is ultimately our culture. Right. You know, and as leaders, we have to be in tune with that in order for us to be able to understand the real effect that we have on our organization in terms of how we project that energy. Right.
Yeah.
You know, so that's where, for me, that's where mindfulness comes in is using it as a tool, not as the end all, it's not the answer. It's a tool to help us get somewhere else.
Yeah.
Right. It's a vehicle. And I think that's what's really important with mindfulness. And there's a lot that we don't understand about mindfulness, or maybe a lot that we misinterpret about mindfulness,
yeah.
Right? Where you know, and I know plenty of people who, oh man, I practice mindfulness all the time, and I'm all of this kind of stuff, but they're completely disconnected,
yeah,
from how they live on a daily basis and those 20 minutes a day that they practice mindfulness meditation, right? You know, there's no crossover. There's no how do you call it? Integration,
yeah,
right? Into how they're actually applying mindfulness in their daily lives, and and that mindfulness needs to transfer over into every single silo, right, of their life. You know, whether it's sports,
yeah,
right, or whether it's work or parenting, or you know, all of that kind of stuff. Versus, no, it's an activity that I do 20 minutes a day, and therefore I practice mindfulness. You know, same thing as yoga and things like that, right? You know, it's the same thing. People practice yoga and think, therefore, okay, I'm done. I have an hour of yoga. I am now holistic. But it doesn't work that way unless you're allowing the learning lessons and things like that that come from this to transfer over into the daily decisions that you make in your life, right? You know, and that's the same thing that counts with leadership.
Yeah.
You know, is how are we using those things from a leadership perspective in terms of how to be a more positive influence on our environments?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, a lot more work, you know, it's so much, right? I'm like totally out there. Yeah.
No, we could go on and forever because, I mean, it's not a tick box exercise, right? Mindfulness is not a tick box exercise, right? If you run 3K, right, and then never run again for 4 weeks, you know, it doesn't make you an athlete, right? It's a consistency.
Right.
It's a continuous practice. And I think mindfulness, and just because I read the book just now, I mean, George kindly reminded me of Viktor Frankl, right? Who I quote probably in every mindfulness course I teach, and I'm sure you're the same, you know, stimulus and response, right? The gap between stimulus and response. To be able to be in that moment, and you know, and when George teaches it, it's all about, you know, if I say the flow as an athlete. But I think for leadership, making decisions, you know, whatever it is, you get the stimulus, and then actually taking the decision time before you actually respond, and having that flow, I think it's for me what makes mindfulness that's a tool, right?
That's right.
And yeah, I saw a video the other day. Someone described it as a rubber band, right? It's like stretching time almost, right? And being able to your point, right, bringing it into the different silos. And you know, whether that is when you're angry at your kids, right, because they did something, or your spouse or whoever you're angry with, and you shouldn't be angry in the first place, of course, right? But angry with yourself, right? And
but we're all human, yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, I think I mentioned that earlier before we went live as well, right? I noticed last week how stressed I was at the end of the day. And I'm like, why am I so stressed, right? I'm working for myself. I decide, right, how much time I put in. And it shouldn't have an effect on my children and my family life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's up to everyone else to or everyone themselves to act how they want to act, and mindfulness helps as a tool. And then, I mean, a couple of things you mentioned earlier in terms of, you know, your vision, you know, your reality. You know, obviously, there's a lot of work been done by NLP, right? Neuro-linguistic programming, as you know, I'm sure you studied, similar to myself.
Yeah.
You know, the map of the world, right? It's, you know, you decide how you see the world and how you interpret the world. And mindfulness can definitely help with that.
I think if anything, right, mindfulness is gives us the power of choice.
Yeah.
Right. It gives us, you know, and where when other people, you know, or generally when people feel they don't have a choice, right, they don't have a choice to, respond in a certain way or act in a certain way or do anything like that. It allows us to you know, in Tai Chi, right, Tai Chi, we talk about separating yin from yang.
Yeah.
Right. From action, from inaction. Right. You know, and when we are in a situation that we're emotionally very heavily invested in, you know, oftentimes we don't feel we have a choice.
Yeah.
And so therefore we act on that. Right. As where mindfulness is kind of that circuit breaker. Right. That allows us to create that separation where we can make a conscious choice. And we also are aware that we always have a choice. And when we have a choice, we can still choose to behave a certain way.
Yeah.
Right. But we're doing it consciously.
Yeah.
Right. We're choosing consciously to do it. And the moment we have that power of choice, we have something that we have control over. And that in itself already reduces stress. Right. You know, just knowing that, hey, yeah, I'm going to do it, but it's my choice. This is the way I want to do this. Right. You know, I can be angry. Absolutely. And if I want to behave angry, I can choose to behave angry.
Yeah.
Right. But it's my choice. I don't become angry. I don't have other people make me angry. I don't have, you know, and it's that's the difference. Right. You know, and I can be stressed. I can give myself permission to be stressed, you know, but that then becomes a conscious choice. Right. And so that is, I think, the beauty of mindfulness is that ability to separate that out further. Right. You know, so where you create a bigger gap in that space between action and inaction and reaction. Right. You know, and so that's the, you know, I think one of the great powers of it.
No, absolutely agree. And I never forget. I couldn't even tell you how many years it was into my mindfulness practice. When I realized that certain things you cannot change, right, because they're out of your control. And I used to, you know, if I say maybe it's my very traditional German upbringing in terms of being right and wrong, right, where I go like, oh, this is wrong, but you can't change it. Until I got to the point where I started just laughing, right? I almost reminded myself of being a Buddha and just started laughing and probably more at myself than anything else and realizing there's nothing I can do, right? Why worry? Right. I think when you get to this point, you start noticing what mindfulness can do and how you can, you know, utilize it for yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I heartily agree.
Yeah. So we talked so much already. I'm kind of thinking, I mean, it's your life show. So if I say I go with your guidance, you know, how much else we want to cover. Is there any questions I haven't asked you yet, which I should ask you?
That's a great question. I just, you know, I'm one of those, you know, I just, you know, just absolutely take it. And I think we've covered, you know, through a lot of storytelling, but I think we've covered quite a lot of, you know, kind of the concept, right, of mind body, connection, awareness. And, you know, even to a point where how, you know, society is stuck, right. You know, and we see, and I think becoming unstuck, right, is such an important part of the work that we do, right? You know, is helping. There's so many leaders, so many board of directors, right? That are stuck in seeing things and doing things a certain way. They have this default operating mode, right? That has inherently worked for them. Right. Because I think that's the other important thing is that, you know, when we get stuck, it doesn't necessarily mean that we have a problem. Sometimes we can get stuck because it's working. right? You know, and that can make us stuck as well. And so when we get stuck with a certain operating mode without that conscious awareness, we stop opening ourselves, you know, to other opportunities and learnings and all of these, and adaptation, right? And evolution and all of these kind of things. So I think, you know, for the sake of this conversation, it really is kind of around is what can we do, right? You know, that, that helps, you know, and maybe that's a great mission statement for both of us, right? You know, is it really is about, you know, helping these leadership teams and these organizations become unstuck, right? You know, and free themselves from either what's working or what's not working, right? You know, to create a place of curiosity and exploration rather than a place of thinking that they know, right? Because you know, as I wrote in a post, you know, I think it was yesterday, is that curiosity and knowledge work like antagonists when it comes down to wisdom. Right, you know, and it's like my arm. If I want to flex my arm, right, you know, if I flex my arm this way, my bicep has to contract to make my arm flex. But if I want to straighten my arm, my triceps in the back of my arm has to contract. That makes my arm straighten. So if I bend my arm, the only thing that my triceps has to do is has to relax, right? Yeah. And so in order for me to let the biceps do the work. The same works with curiosity and knowledge. Curiosity is what flexes the arm. Knowledge is what strengthens the arm. If I get stuck in my knowledge, I can't bend that arm anymore, right? And so I get, and that's what knowledge does. Knowledge, the moment we start thinking that we know, once we start believing that we know this is the way, this is what it is, we stop becoming curious.
Yeah.
Right? And curiosity is what drives innovation. You know, and so for an organization has to be able to do both. They have to acquire knowledge, but they have to be curious at the same time, and they have to be able to apply both at the same time. And that requires a great deal of mindfulness, right? To be mindful that the moment that we start saying, listen, I know this is what we have to do, this is the way of doing it, that actually, it might be the case, but it might also be a red flag to say, hey, are we getting stuck here? Is there another way that we can explore this, right? Yeah. You know, can we be curious about this, right? You know, rather than just being stuck in our knowledge. And for teams and individuals to explore in themselves how much they rely on their knowledge, right? Rather than on their sense of curiosity.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and that is, I think, such a powerful point in mindfulness, right? Is that it allows you to consciously do that. It allows you to consciously flex and straighten that arm so that you can actually go somewhere, right? You know, and without that mindfulness and conscious awareness, there's a likelihood that we probably don't even know if we're getting stuck. And I think that's where a lot of organizations are. They don't know they're stuck, you know? And a great example is Nokia, right? You know, when Nokia went bankrupt, you know, a famous kind of CEO's name, but you know, he had this famous saying, right? You know, it's like, we did everything right. We just had no idea what happened.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and that's exactly the thing. They said they did everything right. They knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and to a point where what they were doing wasn't good enough. It wasn't working, you know, but because they had lost that sense of curiosity and sense of self-exploration and drive and all of that kind of stuff, they never bothered looking outside of that realm. And that's what got them. And that's how you grow from being an organization to a dinosaur, right? You know, is when you start thinking that you know. And so that should be a red flag, right? You know, so if you're watching this, right, you know, and you're in that state, and you're like, man, I know what I'm doing, and this is, you know, and I'm right, and this is, that's a red flag. Yeah. And as an organization too, you know, whether you're Google or whether you're Apple or whether, it doesn't matter, Microsoft, if you get stuck and this is what we know, you know, then you're stuck, you know, and the only way that you're going to be able to prevent yourself from ever becoming, because there will be a time where you become extinct, you know, that history teaches us that every animal becomes extinct at some point. There will be a time where you become extinct. And if you want to prolong that as long as possible and maintain some level of relevance, you know, for as long as possible, you're going to have to keep flexing that curiosity muscle. Yeah. And how much courage are you going to apply to do that? So that would be the last thing that I would add to that. But
so where can people find out more about you? Obviously, we're live just now, but for my listeners, is your website the best place?
So, yeah. Absolutely. And one of the easiest ways of doing it is just connecting with me on the web. Just my name, you can find me, Marcel Dana. Yeah. If you look up Headstrong Performance, the book, or just Google Headstrong Performance, or Google my name, Marcel Dana, you'll find tons of me are out there. Connect with me on LinkedIn. Yeah. I do a lot of work on LinkedIn. I have groups and pages, and Volker, that's where you found me as well. So, that's a great place to just look me up and see if that's, you know, that's something that you want to be. And I'm always happy having a conversation. I love especially the subject. So if you have a question or whatever, just reach out and we can chat, and it's never a problem at all. So. And same for you, Volker, for my audience. I actually have your name at the bottom of the screen, and your website. I'm actually going to pop that up right now. So this is Volker's website, BalutaPartner.com. Yeah, so connect with Volker whenever you're on that side of the world and you want to get unstuck or you want to explore this a little bit. He is the guy to talk to. So,
thank you.
So in the UK, Europe. Hey, and maybe we should do some work together sometime.
Yeah, let's discuss that. That sounds good.
Definitely. Brilliant. Yeah, sounds like a plan. All right, my friend.
Put all that in the show notes as well. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I know. No worries, my friend. And it was absolute fun. All right, you too, my friend. All right, so thank you all for coming. I am going to log off in just a second. That was Volker. Great conversation. Of course, I did most of the talking here. So thank you for the interview, Volker. That was fantastic. And remember, connect with Volker either by on LinkedIn or on the internet if you want to get unstuck. And otherwise, just contact me and I can pass your name through as well.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode. Did you enjoy today's experience? If you did, please leave me a 5-star rating on the outlet you're listening to. Do you have any ideas for guests? Any comments or questions? Please email me to volker@balutapartners.com. And don't forget to check out www.balutapartners.com. And until next time, this is your host, Volker Balutapartners.